This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The public face of the Iraq War is its soldiers. Their images, triumphs, and tragedies appear daily on television and in newspapers. But the war extends far from the front lines, back to the home front, to places like Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Fort Bliss, Texas, and Fort Benning, Georgia, where soldiers' wives wait for them to return. Army wives have always formed an integral part of Army life, supporting their husbands and their careers, serving as both mother and father during long separations, easing the transition from post to post, and rallying behind those coping with tragedy. Today, with an all-volunteer Army, where fewer Americans have a direct connection with military life, the lives of military wives may seem more alien to civilians than ever before, its own world, with its own rules, shaped by rank, protocol, and discipline. Today, we will visit this world with a guide who knows it inside out to see how it works, how it functions, and occasionally fails those who live in it. If you've been part of this culture, give us a call and tell us your story. How do you cope with long separations? What's it like to live on a military base? Or even if you're not a military wife or a husband yourself, if you just have a question for our guests, you could join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, scenes from the funeral of civil rights icon Coretta Scott King. But first, Army wives. Tanya Bianc grew up in the Army and is married to an Army officer. She is also a former reporter for the Fayetteville Observer and the author of a new book, Under the Sabers, The Unwritten Code of the Army Wives. She joins us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Is it okay to call you an Army brat?
Yes, I love that title, actually. I'm very proud of that.
And is that how you became interested in the lives of military spouses, who are mainly still wives?
Right. You know, very, very much so. You know, I grew up moving from military post to military post, and I really can't claim any town or state or city as home. The Army is home to me.
One of the central themes of your book, which probably seems simple to say, but which is actually quite complex, is that Army life is very different from civilian life in one key respect, which is that you really have no personal life. I mean, there's no such thing as private behavior, especially if you live on base, that a wife's behavior, even her appearance, can affect her husband's career. Now, that just seems very hard, I think, for most people to envision. Is that really still true?
Well, you know, you have to be aware of how you carry yourself at all times. Appearances matter. Military people like to put their best foot forward. It's a situation where what you do, how you act, what you say can have a positive or a negative impact on your spouse's career and also on yourself and your family.
Why is that? I mean, are husbands, in fact, literally graded on this?
No, it's, you know, the military is just it's a small, tight-knit, and also a very supportive community, but it can also be, a judgmental environment where, you know, perception can override reality. It's very much like a small-town environment. The difference is that, you know, everyone has the same employer, which is Uncle Sam.
What is the zero-defect mentality?
Right. The zero-defect mentality just means that, you know, you can't really have a chink in the armor as a sign of weakness. And, you know, giving 110% and being at your best every day is tough, but it's often required of our soldiers and especially the leadership.
When you were growing up in an Army family, how was this communicated to you that the expectations were also there for you?
Right. Well, there was always just, you know, very high expectations in school with my grades and, you know, just being the best student and person that I could be. You know, my father used to tell tell my sister and me that, you know, he wasn't raising sparrows, he was raising eagles. And that was a very high expectation to have to live up to.
That's a good message, particularly for girls, though. I think that that conveys the message that you can do it.
Yes, yes,
I mean, not
it does.
Not just exclusively for girls, but I'm just saying that at a time when many people think that this is a very sort of macho environment, that, it's all about the boys and it's all about testosterone, I mean, to hear that this is a message of achievement is expected of you, too, as a girl, doesn't strike
me
as awful.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, I'm very proud of my dad and his 30 years of Army service. And I think he did a great job raising us within the military environment.
You don't talk about your own birth family, but if you don't mind my asking, if it's not too personal, did your mother feel a pressure to succeed, to be perfect, to have zero defects?
You know, I think, you know, I actually dedicated my book to my mother and also to the families in our armed forces. But my mother, you know, she was an Army wife during the 60s and 70s. And when my father, in 80s and 90s, actually, but when my father went off to Vietnam, my mother found out 2 weeks later that she was pregnant with my sister. And, you know, back then there was no support for military families and for what my mother was going through. But my mom worked. My mom went back and got a college education at the age of 40, and she went on to get her master's. And she also, you know, was president of the Officers' Wives Club. So she kind of did it all. She was a superwoman. And I'm just as proud of my mother as I am my father.
Did her experience in part lead you to want to explore this aspect of military life? Because as a reporter in the Fayetteville area, you were reporting on all aspects of the military. But kind of is that partly what encouraged you to look at the whole role of the spouse?
I think it did because, you know, I learned a lot from just watching my mother, you know, at a very young age. But, you know, you can tell the story of the Army from a lot of different perspectives. I chose to tell it from the perspective of Army wives because I believe these women are the glue that keeps their families and the Army community together. And one thing, too, I want to add, Michelle, is that, you know, the Army is an amazing life. Most Army couples who have made the military a career will tell you it has also been a very satisfying life. That doesn't mean that it's been an easy life, but I believe it is a noble one. And military wives take a lot of pride in knowing that their spouses are serving our nation.
I'm going to get to our calls in a moment, but I wanted to ask you this. A former Army officer once told me that one of the reasons that the military is known as being one of the most successfully integrated, racially integrated organizations or institutions in the country is that they make it clear what you need to do to be successful, that there's not a hidden agenda, that there's not a hidden code of, you know, we say that this is what you need to do to succeed, but it's really that they kind of spell it out for you. But in your book, it sounds as if there is not that instruction manual for the wives, that it's this kind of Byzantine experience where they're really left to figure out for themselves what is expected of them, but they're punished for it when they are wrong. Is that true, or is there? Is that a wrong perception on my part, that really there is some way to know what's expected of you?
Well, there's no formal punishment, but I think it's a woman who marries a soldier and knows nothing about, you know, military life or the military experience, she has to learn as she goes. And like anyone in life, you learn from your mistakes and hopefully you learn from them and you move on and you don't make the same mistakes again. But, you know, the Army does have classes to help new wives. And, you know, these are free programs. The issue is not every wife is going to take advantage of that. But I would say, you know, you learn from your neighbors who are also in the military on post, and you learn from your new friends and the women in your unit who are seasoned wives and who have been in the military community for decades.
Let's take a call. Here's Doug in Canton, Ohio. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. What's your call? What's your thought?
Going to comment actually on something your speaker said earlier about how the military wife can actually influence the career of her husband. Well, when I got married, I'm a former Marine, and I brought my wife down to base. I was pulled aside several times and actually counseled by officers or higher enlisted men because of how she would dress or her purple. She had purple hair. She was into punk at the time, And it became a very big issue for quite a while.
Between you or for
you? No, not between us, between me and the officers, because I would be instructed that I should make my wife dress better or make my wife do something different with her hair, and I don't believe in that as a, you know, I don't make my wife do anything.
Why should you have made her change? What was their message about why the purple hair wasn't gonna work?
Well, it was,
other than that, it was a fashion statement. And it didn't really go well with the dress blues.
I guess you have to understand, in the Marine Corps, appearance is everything to an extreme, and anybody who doesn't fit a very specific mold is expected to do everything they can to try to get there. And it extends to the wives, it extends to the entire family, and the fact that something was that glaringly different, it was offensive to a lot of people.
Thank you, Doug. How widespread is that as an experience? Do you think that's a fairly common experience?
Well, I can understand what Doug was saying, because in the military there's order. You have structure, discipline, and organization, and there's a good dose of conformity. And so I can understand if your girlfriend or your fiance or your wife shows up with, you know, purple hair, and if she wears suggestive clothing, that most likely will be an issue and a topic of conversation. And where in civilian community, people might kind of, you know, whisper about it in the workplace. In the military, a superior will most likely mention that to the service member, even though it should be a personal issue, not in the military.
So the conformity need extends both to family members as well as the service member himself or herself.
To an extent, especially with something like what Doug talked about.
We're talking about military wives, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. We're going to take a short break. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. We're talking about military wives and the world they live in. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and our guest is Tanya Bianc. Her new book is titled Under the Sabers, The Unwritten Code of Army Wives. And I'd like to bring in another caller. Gabriel in Rapid City, South Dakota. Welcome.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me. Listen, my family has been military ever since, well, I was born. My mother, though, is full-blooded Italian. My father met her over there. Being born in Germany, and then we came over to the U.S., that history is just to imply that my mother had no idea how the United States military system worked. And she opposed verbally, sometimes very verbally, the things that the Air Force did to my dad or employed him to do.
Did it help that they couldn't understand her when she was complaining about them?
Well, no, it wasn't, I'm sorry, I guess I didn't understand what you're asking.
I was assuming that she spoke Italian?
No, she spoke English.
Oh, I was just saying she could fuss them out in Italian and maybe they wouldn't know, but I guess that doesn't really true.
She opposed it, but my point was is that my father's now the station captain of Ellsworth Fire Department here in Rapid City, and he's been there for 22 years, and what ended up, I find that the people that she talked to about this, his coworkers, they didn't think of him as negative or of image, because these men respect the rights to which they're defending. And that was my mom's right as an American citizen now to be able to voice her opinion about what was happening.
Thank you, Gabriel. Gabriel makes an important point. I mean, you're defending democracy, but it seems as a way that you're squelching it in a way among your service members. You're sort of telling them what to wear. And Tanya, does it strike you that way? Did it strike you that way?
Well, that's the great irony of it, and our military community is aware of that. You know, the military itself within the military community is not a democracy, although we are defending the democracy of our country, and you know that's just how it works.
Your book tells the stories in detail of four different women and their husbands, four very different stories, four very different backgrounds, and I'm not going to go into detail about all of them, but there's some really sad things and some really sad stories. But the catalyst for the book centers on the 2002 murders at Fort Bragg, which you covered as a reporter, when it was, I believe, that four service members killed their wives in the course of something like a 6-week period.
That's right.
And did you conclude that the culture played some role in this tragedy?
Well, what happened? You know, the Pentagon released a 41-page report on that. And what they discovered was that it was several things. It was a combination of existing marital problems compounded by the stress of a hectic training schedules and lengthy deployment separations. And, you know, it just wasn't one thing.
But I want to talk to you about, when you talk about deployment schedule, help people to see what we're talking about here, because many people have spouses who travel, you know, on business trips and things like that, and they may not understand what you're talking about. For example, how much notice would you typically get if you were going to go away on a long deployment? When might you find out that your husband might be gone for 4 months?
Well, when your husband finds out and when you find out, meaning the wife, can be two different things. Sometimes husbands will know months in advance, but they cannot mention it.
Why not?
Until maybe for security reasons. They may not be able to mention it until 2 to 3 weeks out. But sometimes, you know, you'll have a good chunk of time. You may have, you know, half a year. You'll know that a deployment is coming up. And other times, you'll have, you know, very little notice to prepare for something like that.
Well, you tell a story in your book of one couple, of a young, very young married couple with three little children. And they knew that the deployment was coming, but they got the phone call, and the dad was scheduled to leave the following morning. It was 4th of July weekend, and he got the call while they were watching the 4th of July parade. And just the thought of how traumatic this would be, it just brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah, it was really sad. And I know what that feeling is like, having gone through it myself. It's the inevitable. And, you know, as Rita, the woman, the wife you're referring to, you know, she said it was like, you know, waiting for your execution. You know it's coming up, and you know it's going to happen, and then you get, you know, the phone call or the day arrives, and it's just, you know, it's a very sad feeling.
I'd like to bring in another guest now. Joining us now is Margaret Harrell. She's a senior social scientist at RAND and the author of Invisible Women, Junior Enlisted Army Wives. She's also a military wife, and she joins us from her home in Lake Ridge, Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Margaret Harrell, you're familiar with the Fort Bragg murders also, and I wondered, well, no, actually, that's not what I want to start with. I want to start with, clearly on a human level, our hearts go out to these women. They are carrying a heavy load. There are many single parents in our society who have to serve as both mother and father to children, who have to carry on a lot of responsibilities. But why should the concerns of military wives be of particular concern to those of us who don't have to live that life?
Why should we
care?
And care about them?
Yeah.
Well, I can speak from a couple perspectives. You know, doing research for the Secretary of Defense's office, you know, DOD is very concerned about military wives because they know that it's not just the soldier that decides whether or not to stay in the Army, that it's usually a family decision. So they call it taking it to the kitchen table, and they know that families together make these decisions. So from DOD's perspective, it's an issue of national defense. But they also recognize, and they actually have a document out called the Social Compact. And in the Social Compact, what they say is that they recognize that service members are making a huge sacrifice for their country, and that really it's become the right thing to do to make sure that military families are taken care of. It's part of the deal they've made.
You're saying that the fact that a service member may enlist might be just up to him, but that if he stays, that's a family decision.
That's a family decision.
Has the amount of support that Army wives or military wives in general get over the years, has that improved?
That's improved a lot, actually. There used to be a saying that if they wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. And people still laugh about that now. But in reality, DOD in general is much more cognizant of military families, and they're working very hard to improve quality of life for military families. I would say that if there's anything unfortunate there, it's that even though they've done a lot more for military families, that often what they do is sort of, I say in some of my published work, on the backs of officers' wives. In other words, there are a lot more enlisted soldiers that are married today, and so they're working very hard to try to take care of those families and those wives. But often what they're doing is relying upon the volunteer work of officers' wives to take care of those other wives.
Why is that? Do they just not know that these pressures are there? Is it something that's just gone under the radar? Is it that these women don't complain, so therefore no one knows that they're suffering? Why would that be?
Why?
I mean, this is an organization in which the sense is that nothing is left to chance.
Why would they depend upon officers' wives?
Sure. Why would, is there not a more structured form of support?
Well, it's just that, you know, given the world of limited resources, you know, they do what they can with money that they have, but this is a bigger problem than what they can just solve with the funding that they have for family programs. And really what they need to be doing and what they're trying to do is reach out to all these families. And to do so, they generally depend upon the unit leadership and often the wives of the unit leadership, if the soldiers are men, to take care of the other families.
Let's take a caller. Here's Kathy in Grand Junction, Colorado. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. I have a comment that I think is very important, that in the military we have the National Guardsmen. My son is a National Guardsman. He was deployed overseas. And they lack the support that people have on base. Things that would not be a problem in a base city becomes a problem when they're away from a base city. So I think we need to remember that group of people also.
Kathy, thanks. An important point. Margaret Harrell, what about that, that we are relying more and more on our National Guard troops?
Well,
do you think that her point is valid, that there is less support for those service members and their families?
Absolutely. And, in fact, I'm leading a large study now that DOD has asked us, the RAND Corporation, to look at how better we can support not just National Guard families but reservist families as well. Because there's a recognition that they are different, that they may likely have different needs because their demographics are different, and because they are geographically dispersed and not near large installations to a large extent.
Let's go to another caller. Here's Jan in Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome, Jan.
Hey, I was going to say, my mother, when Dad was in the Air Force, this started in World War II and went through Vietnam, was not allowed to have a job, because the Air Force felt it would take her away from her primary job of supporting my father.
I'm sorry, can I stop you right there? You just made me perk right up. What do you mean she was prevented from having a job? Was it a direct order, or was it that her husband was told this would reflect poorly on you?
Women who were permitted to have jobs, the only wives, were the so-called professionals. In other words, if you were a teacher or a nurse, you could work. If you were anything else, it was considered non-professional, never mind if it had, say, my job of working in a hospital laboratory or, say, a reporter even. That was considered non-professional, and it would take away from her ability to support her husband. The reason for the absolute conformity with the wives was it was considered that if the husband couldn't count on his wife, his mind would be on his family situation and not on any potential emergencies.
What did you think about that?
Well, I was a little kid, and that was just the way things were. I mean, I was raised within five rings of a sax phone. If my folks were out bowling, I expected to be in the house beside the phone, either doing homework or having my friends over or watching TV. I could do anything, so long as I could get to that phone. So it didn't occur to me that not letting mother do something was unusual. I mean, heck, at that time, the Air Force could have moved us with 36 hours notice, a sergeant appointed to take care of our household goods.
But it seems to have made a strong impression on you.
Well, Mother was an extremely intelligent person who could have had any one of three or four good jobs, mostly in the financial sector. During World War II, she ran a portion of an insurance company, that had before then been absolutely a man's job. But because she was married to an Air Force officer, she was not permitted to even think about it.
Now, I'm really getting into your personal space here, so forgive me to go away. But did you think that that affected your own life choices in some way, the things you wanted to do? I mean, I could see a scenario where you think, you know what, it was not a bad life.
Well,
let's
keep it going.
Or it could be, you know what, I'm not going to have anybody tell me what to do. Purple hair, piercings, it's going to happen.
What I really wanted to do, now remember, this goes back, I'm 57, so this goes back to about 1970 when I graduated from college. I really wanted to be a pilot, professional military pilot. Actually, what I really wanted to do was fly Hurricane Hunters, but never mind. At that time, it was, well, honey, why don't you marry a pilot? And after you scrub the house and have his kids and go to the party, if he's in a good mood, he'll tell you about it.
Wow. Well, I guess you wouldn't
right.
do that.
Right. I've got a pilot's license.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Thanks, Jan. This is Talk of the Nation on NPR News. Tanya, Bianca, you are in addition to being an Army brat, which you say proudly, you are also an Army wife, and you are also a very experienced journalist. And we had a visitor the other day who said that there cannot be two cultures more different to each other than the journalism culture and the culture of the Army. After all, in journalism, you know, we have a saying, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. You know, the skepticism,
right.
The anti-authority, you know, the anti-authority bias and so forth. So what, not bias, but you know what I'm saying, that kind of,
yes,
you know, we like controlled chaos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ever find a conflict between your, or have you found a conflict between your instincts as a journalist and your identity as a really lifelong member of this institution?
I've been able to separate the two, and I think I've used it to my advantage, my background with the military. I could understand military culture, and that really helped me tell the story of our Army and our military. It helped me formulate the questions I wanted to ask, and because I could really understand where our soldiers and our wives and their kids were coming from. So I just used that to my advantage.
Why did
and
you?
I think it was a good mix.
Why did you choose the stories that you selected to detail in your book?
Well, you know, it really was not easy finding the right mix of women who had these extraordinary and unexpected circumstances happen in their lives within a specific period of time in one place, but. You know, I was able to find them. And you cannot tell the Army wife story from just sharing the story of a colonel's wife or that of a private's wife. I really needed a good mix from the officer corps and the enlisted ranks.
Is there
I'm
sorry.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. We're coming down to our last few minutes. I just wanted to ask, is there someone in your book who just surprised you, that just was a revelation to you, that told you something about the Army life that you just did not know, even from your own experience?
Well, you know, I learned a lot from the women and from doing this book. And more than anything, I learned how important it is to keep your own identity in this world where there is so much conformity. That would be my advice. I would pass that advice on to other Army wives. Know yourself. And one woman in particular in the book, her mantra was, to thine own self be true.
And is there
and
someone
that can get you through so much.
I'm sorry. And just briefly, is there someone who the Army really failed, in your view, who would have really been better suited to another life?
In the book, you know, is the Army really to blame? That's a question I raise in the book, and I leave that up to readers to decide. I don't actually make that decision for them in my book, because people will have different opinions on that.
We have to go to a break now. I want to thank both of our guests. Tanya Bianc is the author of Under the Sabres, The Unwritten Code of Army Wives. She joined us from public radio station WUNC. And Margaret Harrell, she is the author of Invisible Women, Junior Enlisted Army Wives. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for including me, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
And when we come back from a short break, a final farewell to Coretta Scott King.